The theme in our room was upskilling, retooling. What does the future job look like? And really, a question we should be asking is, will our dream jobs still exist in 2025? Is there going to be new dream jobs in 2030? Joining us for panel session number two is our panel moderator, Aaron McIntosh, again of Deloitte. He's going to be joined by panelist Tim Caldwell, president of Chandos, and Aaron Flynn, GM of Improbable. Good morning, everybody. Eric is the Prairie Manager for Higher Education Transformation of Deloitte and has advised over 100 colleges and universities in North America and the UK. Eric, I'm going to promptly hand it over to you for the next panel.
Great, thanks, Brent. So I'm just going to share my screen here with a couple of slides to give us a little bit of grounding in our conversation, and then I'll throw it over to our other folks on the panel here this morning. So hopefully you all can see my screen here. So I just want to kind of give a little bit of grounding on sort of what we're seeing specifically in Disruptions Alberta generally for both workforce, the economic future of our province, and then specifically around higher education or ways in which learners are kind of navigating sort of the scenarios that we have before us today. So obviously, pre-COVID, you know, we had some challenges here in Alberta. We've had issues around the price of global price of oil, getting our products to market, and therefore the impacts on royalties, the provincial expenditures that are associated with things like high costs parts of our communities like healthcare and education. We're seeing, you know, ever shifting learner needs that are changing. So one of these challenges is, you know, adapting to the career paths of those that are pursuing the gig economy. If you've been following the news lately in Alberta, seeing things like Athabasca University coming out with these new make your way kind of programs, new ways for folks to be able to piecemeal courses together to be able to meet their need. Because what students are finding and learners are finding is that, you know, it's hard to go and go back into a traditional kind of degree pathway to upskill. And so can they just take the courses that they need? And so this is really created some challenges for our post-secondary landscape in meeting those needs, because traditionally it's really been built around degree pathways and program pathways for learners. So we think about these broader kind of concepts around learners, and not just students in post-secondary, but people who are in the workforce trying to figure out, how do I upskill? How do I be prepared for that next shift in my career? So these sort of disruptors that we see in the landscape are everything from the expectations of learners, how they want to learn, the pace, the price, the way in which they want to be able to self-select and find their way through this kind of gig economy that's now connected to the learning space that we have. And we see that in some cases, industry is adapting to this much more quickly and nimbly than some of our post-secondary traditional learning providers, because these larger corporations are able to bring learning in-house or able to facilitate on behalf of their employees the ability to then navigate the different learning needs that they have. And for traditional post-secondaries, it's trying to attract people. So what is the value in a post-secondary credential? Can you take the time to be out of the workforce in order to learn full-time as a student, or can you find something that's part-time along with part-time work? Just the overall costs associated with formalized credentialing. And then going back to Stephen's talk, how does that connect into our future of work? How does that actually open doors for me down the road, whether it's a credential in hand or whether it's just a job placement opportunity? There was a survey last year in the US seeking people's input around the value of an MIT Harvard credential or a Facebook or Google co-op or internship. And roundly, people said that they valued that Facebook or Google co-op type internship placement more than the value or the perceived value of a degree from MIT or Harvard. I found that pretty fascinating as a person who studies higher education, that all of a sudden now there's different kind of value in the marketplace for something like that. And then also then, of course, shaping this as employer expectations. So what do we expect of people that are coming into our corporations and our organizations? How do we expect ourselves to then navigate with people in order to help them achieve the skills that we need? What do they need to bring to the table themselves? you know, this is, I think, trying to strike this balance of where's the best job training and job equipping apparatus. Is that formal higher education? That seems like it's an immensely inefficient mechanism for on-the-job training versus employer-led or industry-led training opportunities. And so how do we strike that balance between these two? So I want to use these kind of just as our as initial kind of grounding slides for discussion. And our co-folks on the panel here for discussion can kind of take these sort of and extend them or go into sort of different other areas. So I'll specifically think about comments now from Tim Coldwell, who's joining us as an innovator, early adopter of technology, specifically in the areas of development and construction. So Tim, I'm wondering if you could share specifically insights, suggestions that you have based on kind of the conversations we've had unfolding here this morning so far on the ways that you see students and kind of career navigators transitioning to grow, specifically either in your sector or just broadly here in Alberta. Love to kind of just have you jump in the conversation and sort of add some color as you're thinking here this morning.
Great. Happy to be here today. It's a really good conversation thus far. I'm going to zoom out big picture. A couple things. The idea that construction workers need to be restrained into a different kind of work, I wouldn't say that we subscribe to that. And so if you look at the construction industry in Canada, the entire industry is about $140 billion of Canada's $1.8 trillion GDP. The construction industry employs 1.2 million people in Canada. And the number one predictor of activity in the construction industry is population growth in a geography. And there's a whole bunch of data around this, but various organizations are modeling out Canada having a population of 100 million by the year 2100, 65 to 70 million by the year 2065. And so if you think about that, in the next 80 years, this country needs to build three times as much stuff that's already there. And we need to deal with the infrastructure deficit, which is a big problem. It's quantified as trillions of dollars. And so the construction industry will be a great place to be over time. Now, having said that, the challenge the construction industry has is that there's decreasing enrollment in the trades. When was the last time you talked to a junior high student who's excited about being a plumber? They're more interested in going and developing computer games and working for Electronic Arts or Microsoft or somebody. So we as an industry have a crisis in terms of talent and attracting top talent to the industry. I actually think once you unpack what it actually means to work in the construction industry, it's a very compelling place to work. It's not about hammers and nails generally. And we're doing some really cool stuff in the areas of virtual design and construction. You're putting on Oculus Rift goggles and walking around in a virtual representation of the building, collaborating with people around the world in virtual work teams. And that technology is out on the job sites as well. So, you know, I think the industry really needs to grapple with that. Another kind of thought that we have, you know, a lot of people give an example of technology transformation in the trucking industry in North America, right? So everyone's going to be replaced and the truck drivers are going to be out of work because of technology innovation and autonomous vehicles. That kind of stuff is happening in the construction industry. And the thing that I'm really interested in as a leader is what responsibility do we have as business leaders to help our people be prepared for the jobs of the future? An example I have of that is I'm pretty good friends with the global head of innovation for AirUp, one of the largest engineering firms in the world. And he's famous for saying that they've got 5,000 structural engineers today. And in the next 5 years, he thinks they need 3,000. And they're going to do twice as much structural engineering 5 years out from today because of the automation that's happening in the design industry. So you would think of that in the construction industry. And I think they kind of balance out, you know, the lack of people going into the industry probably is offset by the technology innovation that's happening in the industry. So technology is going to transform jobs. The lower level work that was there will start to be gobbled up, but there's less people going into the industry anyway. So that's kind of an interesting thought process to think about that. I'm going to finish my comments with a quick story just to kind of paint a picture for people of where I think this goes. And I always like to keep it rooted in what's happening today for real, as opposed to kind of a futurist view of what might happen in the future. Everyone rolls their eyes about, well, that's not going to happen. The change is not going to happen as fast as people think. So the classic example that I put out there for the construction industry is a contractor in San Francisco called Katerra. Some of you will know of them. I find that many people don't know about these characters. They're very interesting. They're backed by private equity money, $5 or $6 billion. They're only about 5 years old. They have 8,000 employees. They've bought dozens and dozens and dozens of companies around the world. And their basic business model is to be the Amazon of the construction industry. So they see a future where contractors like Shandos and subcontractors like Priority Mechanical in Edmonton logs on to a global marketplace, and we buy prefabricated kits of parts of components for buildings. And those components are delivered in a just-in-time basis to the job site. And we assemble those prefabricated kits of parts on the job site. And in so doing, we can eliminate a significant portion of the skilled labor on the job site. And so, they're doing it. They've got $3 billion of sales this year. They're losing money like crazy, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars a year. But Amazon lost money like crazy for a long time and before they transformed the industry. So we would watch that organization very carefully. Shandos is known as a leader in a delivery method called integrated project delivery, and that allows us to get the same benefits of vertical supply chain integration that you would get through M&A without the capital outlay of M&A. And so we're one of the North America's leaders in that delivery method. And so we can do the sort of things that Katerra is doing with billions of private equity behind them. We can do the same sort of things through partnership and collaboration. And I think that also starts to define the future of the construction industry. This idea of I have to own it and control it in order to integrate a supply chain, I think is total nonsense. And I think we can get the same net effect through collaboration. And if you unpack what Katerra is doing and where I think the industry is going, you end up with a global network of suppliers of prefabricated materials. And the future would be the general contractor buys those materials and supplies them to the local subcontractors. Right now, 90% of the materials in the construction industry are provided by local trades. So where you go with this is the future skill that's required for a general contractor is less about how you put things together on the job site and more about knowledge of a global supply chain and where to buy the prefabricated widgets and how they all go together, completely different skill set. So that gives you a sense of where the jobs are headed in the construction industry. And then if you unpack that at a local level, if subcontractors are mostly doing labor and assembling materials that are supplied to them by others, they're just a labor company in essence. And the only way that you can differentiate if you're a labor company is to say that my labor is better than your labor. And the way you do that is you bring education in-house. And I think the future will also have many private businesses taking education in-house, collaborating with local post-secondaries, but developing proprietary approaches to their business so that they can win the war for talent in terms of labor at the job site level. And the last comment that I'll make is there's this other kind of idea that I find it really interesting. People love to buy stuff from Amazon, kind of a faceless global organization, but they also want to buy local. And Shandos is a B Corp, or the largest contractor in the world that's a B Corp. And so I think the idea of using business as a force for good and using your supply chain to deliver local benefits to a community is a very powerful idea. And so where that ends up going is we may buy materials from a global supply chain, but we're going to hire local and we're going to create jobs locally. And I think we see government policy in Canada supporting that way of being. It's a very interesting thought process in terms of where the supply chain and construction goes in the future.
That's awesome. So Tim, just really quickly before I ask Aaron some questions, if we were in our setting together as a conference and one of our attendees jumped in an elevator with you after this and was like, what you said was just super captivating. What would be, I'm a new undergrad, let's say, what should I be thinking about in order to kind of pivot into the work world that you just described? What kind of skills do I need to be consistently thinking about acquiring or refining as an emerging professional? What would be that advice that you'd give that person?
I'll answer with kind of just repeating what was told to me by a really well-known structural engineer down in the US. And his comment was, is the automation and the technology doesn't put the soul into these buildings. And so in the past, you may have been able to differentiate yourself on the basis of a technical degree and run your spreadsheet and do the technical analysis, but technology is going to do that. So the future of differentiation in terms of your own personal brand starts to head towards the soft stuff, the ability to put the soul into the project, into the work, make it come to life. I think that is in short demand these days.
Awesome, thanks. I'm gonna then now open it up for some comments from Aaron Flynn. So Aaron, you're the GM of Improbable, an international games company, and key presence here in Alberta. You're recruiting some of those people that Tim mentioned who are less likely or wanting to go into the trades. They want to create games. They want the funky new office in the new downtown building that can, I don't know, play ping pong and also solve the problems of coding or whatever. So I'm curious, you think about how you see technical advancements in things like AV, VR, mixed reality. How are those playing, into the way that we think about learning, remote work, the way that companies are interfacing and with both one another, with their employees, and engaging those employees in new skills and training? Kind of talk to us a little bit about kind of that space in general.
Yeah, happy to, Eric. And let me just say, great comments, Tim. Fascinating. And I can tell you that based on just that very brief but insightful overview of the size of the industry that you're working in, we have many of the same challenges. The war for talent is pervasive, I think, across all industries. And so we are losing people to other organizations, other industries all the time. But a lot of what you said in terms of everything from putting the soul into things to how we're going to compete for that talent, how we're going to do it is absolutely resonates with what we do here. We have the very same playing field we have to think about. When I, look at our business, I look at our industry, there are a lot of similarities with what Tim said. So let me highlight a few and let me talk a little bit about where I think those things matter. So I think we've all agreed at this point that work is changing and that all this is happening. And something that Sam Pillar said, I want to go back to in one of the previous sessions, was these generation times are shrinking, right, between these disruptions and stuff. And so what I've come to believe is that I think we're probably inside some set of bookmarks, inside some set of timelines, where probably continuous learning has to be a major factor in anybody's career plan or anybody's thinking as how they're going to grow their skills. And I think the recognition of that is simply that, the job you're going to have today or tomorrow is not the job you're going to have in the future. That's just a fact now. My mom was probably one of the last folks who spent her career at one organization. And I think that's going to just be, it's gone the way of the dinosaur. And you will now be having not just different organizations, but very different careers. And so I think that speaks to some of the stuff Tim has said. If there was an opportunity for one of our engineers, for example, to take their lessons learned in AI or in virtual reality, for example, and go apply it to something interesting like the global construction industry, I think that would be enticing to them. I think you start to see that moving back as that technology gets adopted there and technology becomes a very foundational piece of just how work is done, less about it's less owned or less kept behind the offices of a few organizations. And so on this concept of relearning and everything, we at Improbable as making games, I think for the first time in a very long, in my career doing this for 20 years, we're seeing computers via machine learning and AI and procedural content generation. We're seeing those techniques able to augment human work now, creative work, to the point now where it makes meaningful business sense to let them do that and create effectively hybrid roles, right, where people are not just expected to tap, tap, tap and create everything themselves. They are interfacing with a machine to do that. And so it's been quite enlightening. I haven't done this in my career before. This was something we carried over with Improbable. For a bit of background, Improbable as a company focuses on harnessing huge amounts of cloud compute to solve problems. And so we create some of that technology specifically for the games industry, but broadly speaking, you can harness these massive amounts of computers available to you for really any problem solving. Simulation is sort of the broadest category of that. And so we solve those, we apply that specifically for games industry problems, and there are a lot. But it's fascinating to watch, once you get your head around this paradigm, it's fascinating to watch people begin to embrace this and do that. Kasparov, you know, the fellow who finally lost to Deep Blue there, the chess champion, he calls this the centaur model, that human beings will be kind of welded with you know, computers. They're the horse parts and the human part is the top part. And that this is the model of the future. He said we won't get to a point at any time soon where any part will replace the other. Instead, you know, the best are going to be these centaurs. And I really think that's very astute. And so I think a lot about the future of work is being that and being, you know, how we're going to augment what humans can do, even to the creative stuff, even to the things that traditionally you would say a computer could never help you with, technology could never help you with. Now we're seeing the first inroads into that with some of that creative work that our developers are doing. So, it's a fascinating time. You know, COVID has only accelerated some of this, I think, in our side of the industry. You know, COVID hasn't slowed anything down that we're doing. We're lucky that way. Knock on wood, we're very, very appreciative that of all the terribleness that is COVID. We're on some of the silver lining side of that. But even as we work from home, you know, we have to recognize that human beings are still the things that we have to care for and believe in and support. And so we've got to find all ways to use this technology to help them get through this very difficult time too. So hopefully that will be over a year, 2 years. I don't know at this point, but then I think we'll find this, you know, new renaissance of things that come out once we can get back to working very closely together and bringing the best parts of the human side of things together again. So hopefully that helps share some of my thoughts.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. I look forward to being able to share coffee with my colleagues again in the same room, right? So some of those kinds of water cooler type conversations that's where both innovation, ingenuity, problem solving, all those kind of components come together because of the way we can interact in the workplace together.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So we're going to have a chance now to go and interact together in breakout rooms again. So I am looking over to Jeff. I'm assuming that's going to be you who's going to teleport us all over. So you can be our red shirt for those of you who are Star Trek fans. You're going to beam us all over to our breakout rooms. We'll have some more conversation there, and then we'll come back when our timing is up.